From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with J.W. Richards, author of Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, A Christian Guide to Fasting. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and J.W. Richards in their conversation.
You alluded to the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus places fasting on par with prayer and almsgiving as an act of righteousness, not to be seen by men, but by our Father who sees what is done in secret. I want you to elaborate on that a little bit, because Jesus is tying together prayer, almsgiving, and fasting as a three-braided cord. All three are graces that we learn within the context of the church, and they're transformative.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the funny thing, is you say, okay, well, Jesus didn't command us to fast, and that's because he assumed that his followers would fast. In Matthew 5, he says, when you pray, when you give alms, when you fast, don't look dismal like the hypocrites. In other words, when you do these things, if they're spiritual realities, you don't want to try to get an external reward by wandering around and being ostentatious about it. But of course you're going to do it. You wouldn't say, well, Jesus didn't command us to give alms. No, he presupposed we were going to do that. And as you said, tying these things together, we think of prayer, obviously, as a supremely spiritual thing we do. We think of alms as an artificial division, but we think of giving alms, okay, well, that's social justice. That's sort of helping people. Yes, we're supposed to do that too. And then fasting, well, we're not sure exactly what that is, but here we have in Jesus really his command, where he presupposes this, all these three things together. And I think that's a perfect example of the unified view that we ought to have as Christians and that Christ, of course, models for us. God didn't just come down as a ghost. He came to earth as a human being, born as a baby in a manger. He lived a normal human life from conception and birth through death. He is human, body and soul, not just a sort of God pretending to be a human being. And in the incarnation, he specifically chose a natural fast. We assume probably he drank water in the desert, but he fasted for 40 days so that he was physically hungry at the end. This is a very physical reality, and I think that when we over-spiritualize the faith, when we try to say, well, all this stuff's sort of symbolic, it doesn't have anything to do with our bodies, we're kind of distilling out part of the message of the gospel, which is, at a certain level, absolutely a physical thing. We believe not just in the immortality of the soul, but the resurrection of the body. And I think part of the truth of that is lost precisely because we've dropped out and quit fasting as an essential part of our prayer life.
And a lot of people are thinking, well, you're appealing to what Jesus said, and I'll go along with that, but why appeal to what the early church did? And they forget the progression from Jesus to the apostles mm-hmm. and then the apostolic fathers and the holy fathers and to every Eucharistic assembly throughout the land. So there's a lot of weight you put on the teachings of the early church that sometimes is minimized in the modern day church.
Yeah, and that is a temptation. I think that there's no reason why if a person is Catholic or Orthodox or Protestant that they need disregard that with the early church, but I think there tends to be a reflexive kind of attitude that, okay, sort of nothing important happened, I don't know, maybe from the end of the writing of the New Testament until, you know, sometime in the 16th century in Europe. That's really just, you know, if you just step back, that's a really odd view to have, that the people that were closest in language, in culture, in geography, that knew either knew Jesus directly or knew his disciples or were taught by his disciples, this idea that they wouldn't have anything important to say or to teach us is just an extraordinary thing. It seems like all things being equal, somebody that speaks the same language that Jesus did, that lives within 100 or 200 miles of where he was on the earth, and that is still in the same culture, that they're likely to understand pretty well what Jesus taught and what he handed down. And so when you find something that's practiced unanimously, as fasting is, this wasn't just an exotic thing that one or two church fathers tried. you can just, you know, every single one of them talks about the miracles and the importance of fasting as a part of the basic Christian life. This is just utterly taken for granted. And so I would treat that as sort of overwhelming evidence that, you know, we should at least give the benefit of the doubt to this practice. And if we're going to not do it, we should have really, really good arguments, I think, to overcome what is really a kind of abiding precedent of Christian practice throughout history.
I want to talk for a moment about the structure of your book, because when I got the book, I read it almost like a novel. I love the way it was formulated, because you're not just dealing with the food pyramids or the way that you ought to eat. It's always interlaced with the fasting. So the structure of the book was very fascinating to me, and it was a very easy book to read.
Well, it's funny because the longer I've been at the writing craft, the more I've really committed myself to trying to write simply, not simplistically, but simply, so that, you know, if a person is an educated seventh grader, they would be able to understand my book. Because I've always felt like it was a failure if somebody said, well, that really seemed important, but it was over my head. That meant that I had failed. I had not communicated to that person what I really wanted to communicate. And so I do think this book, if somebody is used to reading The Privileged Planet, which was definitely written at a kind of higher academic level, this one's written, even though there's a lot of science in this book, I tried to write it so that an educated middle school student would be able to read it. I did ultimately finally structure it around this 6-week plan, because I just thought, okay, most people that are reading the book are going to want kind of basic instruction on how to do this. And I realized that, you know, the more you fast, when you first start out, I mean, I wanted to make this easy. And so I actually encourage readers to, for the first week, not even try to do anything that you'd think of as fasting, but just to eat ketogenically. In other words, to eat in such a way that your body will get rid of the sugars and the carbohydrates it's used to using and will rev up this fat-burning metabolism. And so that requires that you don't eat a whole lot of carbohydrates, that you eat a pretty high-fat diet and moderate protein diet. But when you do that, after a few days, your body starts producing these ketones, which are, again, these fuels that your body takes fat, it converts it to ketones, and then your cells are able to use that as energy. But once you're in that state called ketosis, where your body is producing, your liver literally producing these ketones that your body can use for fuel, fasting becomes easy because your blood sugar is really stable at that point. It's on the low side of normal. You're not feeling these blood sugar spikes that are tempting you to, you know, eat 3 bowls of cereal. And then when you fast, yeah, your stomach might feel sort of hungry, but it's actually fairly easy. But then instead of going straight into long fast, of course, as you know, because you read the book, each week you basically limit the time window in which you eat a little more. So that the second week you limit it so that you just eat all of your meals within an 8-hour time window and you leave 16 hours of a 24-hour day without eating. And so you're basically increasing the amount of time that your body goes without having food put into it. And then the next week, you limit it to 4 hours. So in other words, 20 hours out of the day, you don't eat, and eat all your food in 4 hours, and then so forth over a period of a few weeks until you finally get down to where you're eating a couple of days in 1 week, just about 500 calories, just about a fourth of what you would normally eat. By that point, you are ready to do 24, 36, 72-hour fast without a whole lot of trouble, actually. But it's something that somebody who'd never fasted and suddenly decided they're going to go 3 days without fasting would be absolutely brutal. And so I ended up structuring the book around that plan and then interlacing the spiritual and the physical benefits as individual chapters structured around the 6-week plan.
Very, very different than any diet book I've ever read before. I love to read this book. I've actually, you know, C.S. Lewis said that an unlettered man is a man who reads a book only once. And this is a book that I've read now from cover to cover 3 different times.
Wow.
On top of that, I've gone back and accessed the book for questions that I might have had. So this is not a book that I recommend that people get and read once, because it's so easy to get away from it. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to start to fudge on some of the principles. And I want to start with one of the principles that you've underscored in this book, and that is intermittent fasting, mm-hmm. which, for example, last night my last meal was at 4:30. My next meal, which was today, the first meal of the day, was at 11:30. So I had an intermittent fasting period of time, and you're talking about the health of doing that very thing, and you're saying that though breakfast is a dead metaphor, it really does allude to intermittent fasting.
It does. I mean, this is the sort of current term of art, as you said, intermittent fasting, but that just essentially means that there should be periods of time during the day or during the course of the week when we don't eat and periods of time when we do eat, and those should actually be separated. So as opposed to what I had taught for years that, well, if you want to keep your blood sugar level, if you want to keep your body holding on to muscle and you don't want your body to store fat and go into starvation mode, you need to eat really frequently. You know, eat 6 small meals a day and that will keep everything working really well. It turns out there's never any evidence for this, and now there's a lot of reason to think that's just a really bad idea. What intermittent fasting does, it just says, look, limit the amount of time during the course of the day when you eat, whatever it is.
Don't go away. We'll be right back and rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with J.W. Richards. Hank Hanegraaff wants you to be in the best shape possible in 2020 by engaging the ancient practice of intermittent fasting as a way to experience a deeper life in Christ. Most diet books focus solely on the physical. The Christian Guide to Fasting, Eat, Fast, Feast by J.W. Richards is different because it offers more than a diet. It promotes healing for the whole of you, body, soul, and spirit. It's a 6-week plan that could make 2020 the healthiest year of your life. To receive a copy of Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, A Christian Guide to Fasting, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift in support of the life-giving outreaches of the Christian Research Institute. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal, just 2 of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org.
Like millions concerned about their health, Hank Hanegraaff had never really known which diet plan to trust. But he's found the secret to healing the whole of you, body, soul, and spirit. Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul by J.W. Richards reveals that God is interested in more than just our physical health. He's interested in healing the whole of us. Eat, Fast, Feast outlines a plan found in the ancient Christian practice of intermittent fasting that can help you experience deeper life in Christ. To receive Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, A Christian Guide to Fasting, simply visit equip.org. That's equip.org. And make a gift in support of the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute. Or call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. For decades, Hank Hanegraaff has shared the truth of the historic Christian faith by answering questions over the radio, defending the faith through the written word, and preaching from pulpits around the globe. Today, he is ready to share his life in Christ, as detailed in his most profoundly personal piece of penmanship to date, Truth Matters, Life Matters More. Hank feels closer to Christ than ever before and wants you to learn from his experiences, as recounted in Truth Matters, Life Matters More, so that you can join him on life's greatest journey, the journey toward union with God in Christ. To receive your copy of Truth Matters, Life Matters More, The Unexpected Beauty of an Authentic Christian Life, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
Let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and J.W. Richards in their conversation.
What intermittent fasting does, it just says, look, limit the amount of time during the course of the day when you eat, whatever it is. And so if you go, I mean, most of us, ironically, now eat essentially for effectively 16 hours out of the day, and then we go maybe 8 hours just while we're sleeping without eating, you know, and so we eat something right before we go to bed, and we eat something right after we get up, and then throughout the day. And so the first sort of step to make is just to switch that ratio to go 16 hours of the day. So in other words, remember, that includes, of course, the night when you're sleeping, and eat during an 8-hour window. And that might, it seems difficult if you're not used to doing it, but this is roughly what people did until really the 1960s. I mean, even growing up in the 1970s and 1980s, I can remember this idea that, well, you know, don't eat a bunch of snacks. Eat 3 square meals a day and let that be it. And so that would mean you might eat breakfast at 8, you might have dinner at 5:30, and then you didn't eat again until the next morning when you broke your fast, when you had breakfast. Most of us, though, now we don't even manage to do that. And we now know, I mean, in fact, I had a hard time keeping up with it. The scientific papers coming out talking about various physical and metabolic benefits of actually doing this. And so now I think when I first started working on this, Hank, I felt like, gosh, this is sort of fringe and it will become controversial and it's moving to fashionable. But I think in terms of the physical benefits of this moderate intermittent fasting, I think the scientific evidence for it now is just absolutely overwhelming. And every single day, if you keep up with this stuff, there's another paper about it.
By the way, anecdotally, I can tell you that I used to have breakfast early in the morning because I start my day very, very early in the morning. And then by about 10:30, I'd have a horrible sugar low. Mm. And I couldn't wait to eat again. So I was just waiting to eat again. Now, not eating breakfast, most of the time, I don't eat my breakfast. I love eggs and I love breakfast. So if I'm going to eat breakfast, I eat it at 11 or 11:30 or 12 o'clock. But I push it out. But I don't get the sugar low anymore.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's the funny thing is that so many people, I mean, my wife jokes about it now because she's a pretty avid faster, but she was one of these people who said, oh, no, I think I must have hypoglycemia because I have to go, have to have something to eat every 3 or 4 hours. I just can't handle it. And that's true if you're eating in a certain way. But what we don't realize is that this isn't for most of us some kind of, you know, genetic propensity we have. It's just that we've gotten used to eating this way. We eat really simple carbohydrates that our bodies start converting to sugar the second we put it in our mouths, practically. And we do this frequently so that we're constantly perturbing our blood sugar. Our blood sugar, you don't want a lot of sugar running through your bloodstream. It's actually really, really dangerous. And so your body's really good at sweeping sugar out of your bloodstream. We can hold about a teaspoon or 5 grams of sugar in our bloodstream at one time. If you think about it, that's not a whole lot of sugar. Right? It's like 1/6 of what you'd get in a soft drink. And so your body immediately has to get rid of that. And so what it does is your pancreas releases the substance, think of it as signaling hormone called insulin, that basically tells your cells, okay, absorb this sugar, get it out of your bloodstream. And we do this constantly to ourselves. And then that insulin goes up, it pushes the sugar out of the bloodstream, the insulin goes down, and then that signals, okay, give us some more sugar. And so signal goes to your brain, give me more sugar. And we're on this treadmill where we're actually training our body to keep asking for more and more sugar. And the more we do that, the more we need. And the more resistant our cells get to insulin, so the more insulin that our pancreas has to produce. And then we're on this vicious cycle. And once we're on that, then we think, well, this is just how I am. I can't do anything about it. No, you can. There's actually a way to get off this cycle in which our blood sugar stays steady and you don't have that kind of sugar high and low that most of us experience.
You know, the thing is, you're telling Jay that when I was playing golf tournaments, before I'd actually tee it up, I'd think, I have to eat really healthy today because I want to play really well. And so I'd have a banana and I had some oatmeal. And when I'd start the golf tournament, I'd always sort of had the shakes. And it wasn't because I was nervous. It was I just had the shakes. And I didn't realize until I read your book that it's not just a bad habit of drinking Coke, which I never did, but it's not just that. But you can eat certain foods early in the morning for breakfast that turn to sugar in your system right away. And then you get those shakes, and then you get that odd feeling that has to wear off. And sometimes it'd take one or two holes for it to wear off. And by that time, I was two or three over par.
It doesn't take long. And that's the irony, because I mean, I'm always the same way. I mean, I probably haven't had a regular soft drink full of sugar in 20 years. I just, you know, I knew that. I mean, even in the 80s, when we were all supposed to eat low fat, high carb diets, we knew that sugar was just straight sugar, especially liquid sugar, was not good for us. And so that's the one thing that all these diet regimes all kind of shared in common. What I didn't realize is, you know, yeah, I always ate oatmeal. I eat lots of bananas and lots of fruit. And, you know, under certain contexts, I'm not saying those are bad things, but if that's the kind of main source of calories and you're doing this to yourself constantly, or you're doing it to yourself first thing in the morning, even if you think you're doing the healthy thing, you could still be as much on this cycle as somebody that's, you know, eating donuts and drinking apple juice every morning, ironically.
Talk about dietary fat. We've been told for years and years and years by those that are authorities on diet that dietary fat is bad, that saturated animal fat is super horrible for us. That now turns out to be mythology.
That's exactly right. I mean, what's funny, Hank, is that I was actually had been reading the literature on this before I ever got into fasting. It was about 6.5 or 7 years ago. I had, you know, I had heard people that tried low-fat stuff, and I had heard about this book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, by a guy named Gary Taubes, that was a Science magazine writer, arguing essentially that most of this conventional wisdom of supposed nutrition science is actually wrong. It's based on a couple of flawed studies and then a bunch of advocacy groups. But that, in fact, what's happened is that we've gotten worried. We started panicking in the 50s and 60s and 70s about animal fat and natural fat. We replaced it with a bunch of artificial fat from industrial seed oils and from things that aren't oily, things like cottonseed, right? Things that are not naturally oily, and we stop eating that. And then, of course, we've got to eat something. And so what's happened is we've dropped the amount of natural fat from our diets, is we've increased the carbohydrate and the sugar content. And then that correlates perfectly with the increase in obesity and type 2 diabetes and other so-called metabolic diseases that have just been absolutely epidemic proportions now in the West, in places that replicate this diet. And it really should be counterintuitive if you kind of take the long view. If you look at how animals that eat, what they do, you know, if a lion kills an elk or something, it actually goes for the fatty portions. You know, that's what it focuses on. And so what we've essentially done in the last half of the 20th century is this kind of vast countrywide, and in some ways civilization-wide experiment in which we drop out these natural sources of nutrients and calories. We add these artificial kind of nutrients and calories in the form of industrial seed oils. And then we vastly expand the amount of sugar that we're eating. And at some point, somebody had to connect the dots. And over the last several years, there have been a number of groundbreaking books from Gary Taubes, whom I mentioned, Nina Teicholz, who wrote a terrific book called The Big Fat Surprise, which really exposed just how bad these nutritional studies and advocacies have been that have convinced us that fat was bad. And so I was already very interested in that and already been testing this. I've been testing ketogenic diet eating and low-carb diets. And so I was already kind of primed for that. And in many ways, I had my own intellectual prejudices to get over. The first one was the dietary fat thing, which was the big one. The second was just the idea that it could actually be good for you to go a long period of time without eating, because I thought, well, that's going to put my body into starvation mode. Turns out, again, if you look at the scientific literature on this, it's just not true. And so we're kind of in this lag period in which a lot of the popular imagination in the U.S. News and World Report dietary reports are way behind the times and behind the actual scientific literature, which is actually, I think, on the cutting edge, is telling us a lot of this stuff. And if you're interested in it, you can actually find it, but you've got to get below the headlines, unfortunately.
Talk about the myth of a calorie is a calorie is a calorie, that all calories are created equal. And therefore, you take in a certain amount of calories, you have to do a certain amount of exercise to offset it.
Yeah, it's essentially treating our body as if it's a simple energy system. Because, yeah, in terms of the physics, it's true that fat per gram has 9 calories, whereas protein and carbohydrates have 4 calories. And so you'd say if all it has to, our body's, the only thing that matters is the amount of food energy that goes in, yeah, that would be true. The problem is that our bodies are not simple thermodynamic systems. We're complex biological systems, so that every input creates a particular response. Our bodies are like thermostats. So, I mean, my best example in my own life was my life as a high school student. I was my sophomore year, I think I was 6'3", about 137 pounds. I had worked my way up to about 153 pounds. By the time I was a senior in high school, eating everything I possibly could. Now, the calories in, calories out should say, well, okay, so why wasn't I gaining a huge amount of weight? Well, the reason is the more I ate, the more calories my body used. It would just kind of crank up the energy. And so my body would just use up more energy. That's the kind of basic fallacy of this idea. It's not that calories are unimportant. It's just that our body responds differently depending upon what we're putting into our bodies.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with the author of Eat, Fast, Feast, J.W. Richards. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand the life-changing outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, Hank would like to send you a copy of Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, A Christian Guide to Fasting. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter.
The book, Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, is a true gift to Christians eager to grow spiritually as they get healthier physically. What makes this book unique? J.W. Richards draws on the ancient church's centuries-old practice of intermittent fasting as a way of life in Christ unknown to many modern Christians. Most books that promote diets focus solely on the physical. Eat, Fast, Feast is different because it isn't merely promoting a diet. It's a 6-week plan for a powerful paradigm shift and genuinely holistic health that could make this the healthiest year of your life. To receive your copy of Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, A Christian Guide to Fasting, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.